This is our last session in a series which we've called Violence in the Face of God and Masking the Tradition. And since we have, Christy and I have asked you all to, in the last four sessions, to slug through all manner of violence, oppression, and mayhem, we decided maybe in the last session tonight we would certainly not leave behind the issues that we have talked about, not by any means, but that we would change this last session and make it about images to sustain a new community, the kind of community we've been sort of straining for during this course. And so tonight we want to invite you to think with us about images, stories, language, the kind of symbol system that we have been critiquing in Christian tradition. Now what language, images, stories can really sustain us as people who seek to make connections, to embody community that is of justice making, communities of struggle, perhaps communities of dissent and vigilance. And so that's the subject for tonight, and we're going to initiate that, but for this to really be a happening sort of a thing, you're also going to have to join us in that process. So this is an invitation to do that. We're going to begin by reading two pieces that we had thought originally to be a part of other sessions of the course, but it's just as well that they sort of got squeezed out by the pinch of time, because in many ways they may help to focus us on the topic at hand this evening. One of these is by Martin Luther King, Jr. In a way, it picks up threads that we were dealing with in our session yesterday on war and systemic violence. And King, in his 1967 speech, where he spoke out about the war in Vietnam, makes extraordinary kinds of connections between racism, militarism, poverty, and the sort of other issues that are all that we had up here on the board yesterday, all intertwined in a kind of spiral. He's so good at making the connections, and he calls for a new kind of moral community in the United States. Some of the language of this is dated, but I think you'll find the concerns very contemporary. So here are these words from a speech that Dr. King made. It's entitled A Time to Break Silence, and some of you got to pick this up yesterday. I really encourage you to look at it sometime, because it's in some sense an encapsulation of the thought at the end of Dr. King's life. He says from the pulpit at Riverside Church in New York City, "I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will only be an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It is not haphazard and superficial. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say, this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say, this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, "This way of settling differences is not just." This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, this cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. This kind of positive revolution of values I am calling for is our best defense as a nation. War is not the answer.
I just wanted to share a piece from the book that I talked about the other day, Touching Our Strength, The Erotic is Power and the Love of God. And one of the things that I feel going into this session is that is the real difficult task of I don't think impossible, but the real difficult task of building up the meaning and use of images that are really life-giving. I know at least that I find whenever I read feminist books, including this one, and I may be overgeneralizing, but it's a common experience, that when I'm working through the critical portion of it, I'm going, yeah, that's great. Oh, wow, you know, they've really onto something here. And when it gets to the part of, so what do we put out instead, I kind of go, ugh, and it's not quite there. And I like to believe that that's not because there's nothing to be put there, but that we're really earlier on in that reconstructing work than we are in the deconstructing work. So I hope that even if it doesn't quite grab all of what you'd like it to grab inside you, what we and you talk about tonight, that it is a process that has the possibility of doing that. And even in this book, she, I just think, does a wonderful deconstructive piece of what's going on now. And one of her central images that she proposes is a woman on the cross. And I really want to talk to her and ask her, why does she think this will really help? Because for me, my point of view is, we've been on the cross, let's get down. But she's thought about this long and hard, so I'll grant her that there may be something. But one piece that I find, someone came up to me after the section on domestic violence and said, you know, we've talked a lot about abuse and victims of abuse and what it's like from that side. And they asked me, what about what causes people to perpetrate abuse? And I don't have any sort of treatise on that at all. But Carter has an idea in here that I think relates to church communities that I want to share with you. So let me find it.
I think also it's helpful to listen for the connections between this piece and the King piece, because her idea is that disconnectedness is part of the problem and that connection... I'm sorry, that disconnection is part of the problem that initiates a violent behavior, and there are ways that we might be able to connect the personal and the kind of structural dimensions of it.
Who is this person again?
Her name is Carter Hayward. She teaches theology at Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge. And just to give you a little intro into the quote, she's talking about a team of folks working at Wellesley College that are really studying at the center of the intersection of psychology and feminist liberation theology. And there's a center called the Stone Center for Developmental Services. And they are reworking some of the foundations of psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. I'm going to just skip around a little bit here in quoting. Following their empirical and intuitive perceptions, the Stone Center is proposing that because we become persons literally in and by relation, it is only in mutually empathic and empowering relationships, that is relationships where there isn't dominance and submission, that our well-being can be secured and sustained. Departing from traditional tenets of psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy, the Stone Center proposes that a person's mental health is enhanced as she comes more wholly into her relational power rather than as she learns to be a separate, autonomous, or individuated self. Our growth as persons in relation is facilitated not primarily by differentiating ourselves from one another, but by connecting. It is within our connectedness that we are able to recognize and value our differences. People share a commonality which is beyond similarity. And then here's the piece about abuse. One of the far-reaching implications of the Stone Center's groundbreaking efforts is that the absence of mutually empathic and empowering relationships in our lives as children and adults, rather than active violence against us, may be the root of abuse.
Read that again.
Okay. One of the far-reaching implications of the Stone Center's groundbreaking efforts is that the absence of mutually empathic and empowering relationships in our lives as children and adults, rather than active violence against us, may be the root of abuse. Such an implication would challenge radically and creatively the assumption common among feminist healthcare professionals that abuse is fundamentally a problem of violence, of breaking and violating boundaries. Rather, violence is seen by the Stone Center as a problem of disconnection. We are cut off from the possibility of mutuality and joy in our most important relationships. This is profoundly true from an ethical perspective. She goes on to talk a lot more about this, but what I find interesting here as I think about life in the church is that the church is in the best sense a community, and we live in a society that is so individually based that I may care about something and want to do something, but I sort of have to go out there as an individual and do it. And that the church, I do think, although it hobbles in doing it, is and can be a community for folks. And so as she's talking about the importance of connection in a world where disconnection can perpetuate violence, I see that if the church takes the time and the pain to look at itself honestly, that there's a real hope in the kind of community base to the way we live and seek to live in the church. Okay. One other thing, that was our sort of theoretical piece here, now we want to get into real images. And we thought of two categories of images. One was vigilance and staying, or solidarity is how it's usually termed. And one was celebration in the midst of struggle. So I want to share a biblical story of vigilance. And it isn't a story that I've done extensive biblical research on, but it is a story that I've been deeply touched by, so I was hoping that that would be adequate for for sharing it. And it's a story that I've heard about recently. It was a text that was preached on, forget the name of the center, but at Boston University there's a women's center, and they have a feminist conference every spring. And Renita Weems, who's a African-American biblical scholar from Vanderbilt, preached on this text in light of the recent war. And the background to the text is that David is king. It's from 2 Samuel 21, and it's just a little snippet, 21 verse 10 and following. And David is king in Israel, and there's been a famine for many years. And David goes to God and says, you know, what's the problem here? Why don't you give me any water for the lands? And God says, well, when Saul was king, he killed the Gibeonite people, and I didn't give him any permission to do that. So we haven't ever worked out that relationship again. So you need to go to the Gibeonites and work that out, and if you do, then I'll give you rain again. So David goes to the Gibeonites and says, what shall I do for you? How shall I make expiation that you may bless the heritage of the Lord? And they sort of have this conversation, and
They said to the king, "The man who consumed us and planned to destroy us so that we should have no place in all the territory of Israel, let 7 of his sons be given to us so that we may hang them up before the Lord at Gibeon on the mountain of the Lord." And David said, "I will give them." So essentially what happened is that David gave 2 sons of Saul through Rizpah, his concubine, and that's who the story is about, and 5 other sons from a daughter and another relationship.
You lost me right there.
Sorry. Okay, 7 people were killed as a way to expiate the fact that the Israelites had hurt the Gibeonites. 2 of them were children of Rizpah, who was the concubine of Saul. And these are the words of Rizpah. So the killing takes place, and that's where I'll start. "The king took the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiya, whom she bore to Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth, and the 5 sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel, the son of..." Don't worry about this part. "And he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites. And they hanged them on the mountain before the Lord, and the 7 of them perished together. They were put to death on the first days of the harvest, at the beginning of the barley harvest. Then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiya, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of harvest until rain fell upon them from the heavens. And she did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night. When David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiya, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh Gilead, who had stolen them from the public square of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines killed Saul in Gilboa. And he brought up from there the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan. And they were gathered, and they gathered the bones of those who were hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin and Zelah in the tomb of Kish, his father." That's the end of the story. It may not be immediately apparent what is so life-giving about this story. But
this was my immediate response when Chrissy said, "I want to use this story tonight."
But hopefully, it's particularly, now that you have the context, the lines where Rizpah goes and spreads the sackcloth out for herself at the beginning of the harvest, and it says, "And she did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night." And the image that I have from that is, here's this woman whose sons were killed, and that one of the particularly important moments or ceremonies of the time was at the time of death, that you have a proper burial. These people were hung and left. And what she did is she took her sons and she stood by them. And these are, you know, now they haven't been properly buried, so they're decaying. And I just can imagine this woman trying to keep the vultures off during the day and the wolves off at night. And it doesn't seem like an easy task to me at all. And so the sense that I have of her vigilance, of not just saying, "Well, I can't do anything," to even though this has already happened, that I just have to give in to what happens. Rather, she said, "No, I'm going to remain vigilant." And I think what I hear in the fact that when it says, "And David heard what she was doing," that in that act of being vigilant, she had the power to shame him into coming and saying, "Wow, I didn't, you know, this was evil, this was wrong, and the least I can do at this point is to give these people a proper burial." And so I see that she had the power to remain vigilant with her children, even after their death, to protect them and to move the person who had okayed the killing, the person who had, in fact, held the power to commit the evil act. She was able to create a change in that person, not to save her own children, but afterwards, to not have it be repeated again, perhaps, that there was a change, that she was able to influence David by her vigilance and her love for her children. And as I was thinking about using this today, I was talking with Sherry about it, and Sherry immediately thought of a modern story, which I thought might help even more to see how this might be a hopeful image. So if you could share that with us, I would appreciate it.
When I listened to that story, I immediately had the image of a story that I had read about several months ago. And because I read about it several months ago, and because I don't have the article right in front of me, please excuse it if it doesn't have all of the details in it. However, it was a story about a mother who was watching the TV and saw on the TV her son. I suppose it was a news report, although I'm not quite sure. But she saw her son marching in a gay and lesbian rights demonstration. And all of a sudden, she saw her son being dragged and beaten with the police standing by laughing. And she was horrified that that could happen to her son, because she loved her son very deeply and couldn't imagine why anybody would want to hurt him or that anybody could get any humor out of watching him being beaten. And so she decided that the next time her son marched, that she would march beside him. And the next time this opportunity came up, she marched right out in front of the demonstration, right beside her son. And that happened, I don't know if it was 20, 25, 30 years ago. But anyway, that was the birth of the organization that's now known as Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, PFLAG. Some of you may be familiar with that organization. It's grown into a national organization of people who are in solidarity with gays and lesbians, particularly around the prevention of violence, and also an educational process. For instance, the most important one right now is their, not the most important, one of the newest ones, put it that way, is their emphasis on trying to prevent teenage suicides, because there's about three times as many teen suicides amongst youth who are struggling with their sexual orientation than there are amongst teenagers who are not struggling with their sexual orientation. So that's a woman in solidarity that grew into a huge, actually quite huge organization right now, that's got some national scope, and it was her one act of solidarity marching with her son that gave other people the courage to do more in that area.
Thanks.
Well, before we sort of open this up to a wider conversation, I wonder if I could ask the two of you who have brought a biblical story and told a contemporary story of vigilance and solidarity in the face of a real situation of struggle and tragedy. Why are these stories particularly pertinent and powerful now? You know, what do they say to us about the kind of stories that are helpful in sort of cementing our struggle and sustaining us in the context in which that we're faced with?
Well, for me, what just strikes me about the biblical passage is that, and what it was talked about in terms of the preaching that I heard tell of, and it was sort of interesting, it was like phone calls around the country trying to find out what had been said, because people were sort of excited about it. But just that, I mean, I think this story talks about how women and children suffer because of war, that men are essentially responsible for making the decisions about in this world, but I just get, I mean, for me, I don't know if it works for other folks in the room, but this image of this woman out with you know, keeping vultures, I mean, I feel like she had to, like, stand up and act like a vulture during the day to keep them off during the day. And I don't know how she did it with the wolves at night, but that image, for me, is of a woman, even in the face, even when she can't stop what took place, of finding more strength in that process that sort of allows her to carry on with some hope and create hope in other people's lives, and to change people who commit these kinds of evil acts. So I just hold that image of this really powerful woman guarding her children, and I find it meaningful.
Do you have any?
For me, it has that image of the mother standing in solidarity with her son in spite of all of the hostility that is so often there. For her, the image stirs up in me this sense of extreme courage because of having to struggle with her own feelings, her own struggles with what she has been taught to believe or has felt against a society that is so hostile, and yet willing to put herself out there on the line, even though she may not be quite sure yet what it is that the love of her son, I guess, was so strong that she was able to do that. And I'm not sure, but the courage stands out. And she knew that something was really unjust about the way her child, who was now an adult, was being treated, and she was willing to stand side by side, even though she wouldn't have had to have done that.
I wondered if something, one reason we feel a connection with stories that are about in this case, two women up against impossible power and yet vigilant. Mm-hmm. The reason we have a strong connection, might have a strong connection with stories like that, is because of the way in which things are arrayed against folks at this point in our own society, who seek, international peace or justice for gay and lesbian folks. When the prospect of winning the issue in the public realm through majority vote and that sort of thing just seems impossible. I mean, you were talking the other day about the recent Presbyterian General Assembly and their vote on this report on human sexuality. And they simply nixed basically every forward step and suggestion of the task force that wrote the letter, which was trying to open up and say, we need to consider sexuality more broadly than just sex between lifelong partners in marriage. We need to consider we need to consider more broadly what human experience is in our church and society. We need to find out ways to be tolerant and affirming of gay and lesbian folks. And this was kind of the emphasis of the letter, and it was just smashed by a huge majority in the Presbyterian Church, which is not the most right-wing religious institution in the country by any means. It's kind of, we can tell those stories over and over again. So when you go looking for biblical stories or contemporary ones, it's somehow, how do you hold on in when you're not going to win the next vote? What kind of witness do you make? I wonder if that's why this kind of story has a particular power, because maybe for a time what we can do is to be vigilant and to be a witness, kind of, even though the bodies do stack up. I mean, this story is horribly tragic, the one that Christy has read. It's a woman who holds vigil over the dead bodies of her children. Now, we don't all live in circumstances quite that violent, but certainly sometimes, you know, that's the case.
Well, press now, and that we're starting to see a lot of parents holding dead babies and burying them, and people grieving over the loss of their loved ones, and people that we bombed from, you know, 3 miles up or whatever. So we didn't see those images during the war. There was a crackdown on that. So we're just now starting to see them. And there was a picture in the Chicago Tribune last week of two fathers holding two dead kids and digging holes and burying them. And it was so sad to look at it. But I think that the image that came more strongly to my mind is, I live in Chicago, and I've been an observer recently for a little project in Chicago called the Chicago Foundation for Education, which has made small grants in lots of different public schools, poor schools in the city. So I've gone out to some of these schools to observe what the teachers did with these little tiny grants that the foundation gave them, up to $500. And I guess you have to replace teacher with parent there, but I think some of the parallels hold. Some of the teachers in public housing projects defending and fighting for and trying to preserve the life in those children against such great odds. Mm-hmm. One of the classes I observed was a class of 8th grade children in a grammar school. They were the oldest class in that grammar school. They walked into the auditorium where I was the only observer to observe this event. They sort of solemnly, you know, maybe half of them could have been 30 years old, these children who were 13 years old, 12, 13, 14. They looked like drug addicts, they looked dangerous, they looked hardened, they looked dead. The other half of them had their hair in pigtails and looked kind of cute and bright-eyed and like they were with the program. But the teacher had done a project at the beginning of the year, this year, and said to these kids, if you had any power, what would you say about it? What would you do in the world? What would be your, where would your hearts go? And they sort of did this thing about, oh, we would talk about stopping drug abuse and dropouts from school and teenage pregnancy and shootings and gangs. And, you know, these children they knew what the problems were in their neighborhood. And she said, let's do something about that this year. So what she did was got them to write plays, little vignettes about all these things. So they wrote 12 little plays, and they acted them out themselves. And the children took turns being director of each other. And then they used our little grant to get some video equipment, and they videoed these plays. And then the children said, adults come all the time to our school and tell us not to do these things, not to do drugs and drop out of school and get pregnant and be in gangs and shoot each other. But it's hard for us to hear the adults or the movies that they send us. But we think if we said this to other kids, that the other kids would hear. So they're taking their show on the road, and they're going to the other schools around and putting their play on, and now they videoed it, and they're sending the video around. When these hardened criminal types got on stage, they were darling, and their eyes came alive, and they looked like children again. And I thought, that teacher is such a fighter. She's in there trying so hard, and against such great odds. One of the things the kids learned, that was a research project, and one of the things they learned is that 80% of the children in their district will not graduate from high school and will not be able to read and do arithmetic. 80%, which means one of the things the kids did was number off in classrooms, and they'd go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 of you will fail, the 5th one will succeed in learning to read and do arithmetic and graduate from high school. 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, it was so effective. I sat there all by myself in the auditorium in tears. And this teacher was just a strong, hard, vigilant woman, that she was so motherly to them, and so that brought that to mind.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't happen in real life.
It did happen in real life.
Where?
Chicago.
In Chicago. I was in that auditorium 2 weeks ago.
What section of the city?
Near the Chicago Stadium, for the public housing project.
It's on the south side, right?
On the west side. Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. I believe.
But see, I think one of the things that goes into that is madness.
But we're called to believe as Christians. Sorry, what were you
I think saying? Madness. I think the mother watching her children decay would be mad as a hatter. Mm-hmm. And I think that teacher in that school was a bit mad also. Mm-hmm.
To risk that would be just a single incident. Wouldn't happen. Yeah. I've taught in Chicago.
Yeah, but you got to believe that that kind of thing is possible. Otherwise, you just close the door and close your mind. There's somebody that used some real guts and some creativity. You know, we have a PBS station in California, Channel 9. They did a kind of salute to teachers, unusual teachers, that were all over the country. And their many stories were just like this. Yeah. They were given tremendous odds and turning things around and going at it in a different way, from a different, you know, instead of coming through the door, they came through the window, so to speak. So it can happen. You have to believe that it can happen. Otherwise, you might as well just shut down and say, well, there's no hope.
And this person is changing people's lives. So,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, there is response to that. It's not just sort of an idea. It's a reality. Are you going to say something?
Yeah. If you haven't seen the movie Stand and Deliver, see it. Well, okay, enough said about that. But when I listen to the stories here, I think of the word appropriateness. And for this woman in your story, Christy, the appropriate time for her to be visual was after the seven children had died. In this story, it was when her son was still alive, very much alive, and was able to do a lot. Mm-hmm. In the story, it was a different situation that the children were young before they got hardened. That was the appropriate time. I think during World War II, a lot of people, the people who were praised were the people who were vigilant against Hitler after the war had started. Well, I don't necessarily think that was the most appropriate time for them to be vigilant. I think for people not to succumb to the Nazi regime would have been more appropriate rather than after the fact. And I think of all kinds of situations of appropriateness, where the time to save gas is before gas runs out, or the time to think of new technologies is before we're killed by the depletion of the ozone, these kinds of things. And they're all different. There's no one particular time. It's not after the event has happened or before the event has happened. It just requires constant rethinking and renewing and creativity as far as when the appropriateness of when to act, when to be vigilant is. Mm-hmm.
But you'd never know if you weren't in community. If you weren't rooted in community, if you didn't have a context, you'd never know when the right time was for you to act. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why in Nazi Germany, people didn't, because they were separated. The Jews were in a community and the Christians were, but they weren't inter... I'm not sure. But maybe.
It may be that the disconnection that Carter Hayward is talking about, that yeah. Isolation, is what... I mean, the already kind of systemic anti-Semitism in the culture, in the society, is what allowed the appropriate time to pass. You know, I mean, the right time was not seized. Chris, when you were talking, I thought I've done all of this arcane research on slavery, which is hardly an issue. Many people are trying to reopen, so it seems kind of like dead work. But I occasionally find an extraordinary kind of contemporaneity about the historical experience of people during the time of chattel slavery in this country. And there was a period between the American Revolution and about 1810, 1820, a period of at least 30 or 40 years, when the Protestant churches in the country were a predominant social force in the society. I mean, much more listened to than they are today in U.S. society. And during that period of time, the Protestant churches could have stopped American slavery in its tracks. Almost all of them before 1800 came out with very strong pronouncements against slavery. And they weren't just, you know, like slavery's a no-no, it's unjust, God doesn't like it. They were strong statements about the members divesting themselves, the members of their churches divesting themselves of slavery. By 1820, all of the Protestant churches, except for the Quakers, had reversed their position. All of them. And almost all of them, Baptist, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Episcopal, all had very strong, Mennonite, on and on, very strong statements against. And they missed the moment. And in my own tradition, which is Methodist, it is documented that they missed the moment because they chose church growth over social justice.
That's not
They said, our church won't grow. We've got all this wonderful opportunity out here on the frontier, and our church won't grow if we push the slavery issue. So let's kind of set it. Let's, you know. The leadership of the church made that decision.
And the same decision was made by the leaders of the women's movement at that time to drop, to not include black women because they wouldn't get support of black women in the South if.
And then they might not get the
vote. White women in the South if they were saying that they wanted to vote for black women.
Right. And then the moment passes, and what happened in the with regard to slavery is that then finally the whole southern half of the United States is so involved in slavery as the lifeblood, economic lifeblood, that then it becomes next impossible to extricate it without, you know, civil war. Similar kind of thing.
Yeah, and the American women's movement is still dealing with that separatist decision that was made way back then.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's what happened in Germany, too.
I'm trying.
Yeah, the snowball so fast.
Sorry.
I had family in Germany. Yeah, the snowball so fast that they weren't able to reverse the movement of the Hitler.
The gay and lesbian thing in the church today seems to be facing very much the same issues. I mean, publicly, people are arguing biblically about it, whilst privately, the underlying theme seems to be that people are terrified that the gays in and the church won't grow, the church will go into decline because people will leave.
Exactly. Do folks have other images they think of or stories they hold particularly dear that give you strength?
Yeah. I was working with peace activists in Boulder, and I canvassing door-to-door for Sane Freeze, which is a national lobby that works against nuclear arms production and environmental issues and South Africa issues, Central America. And I learned a lot from the commitment of the activists that I worked with, because their whole livelihood depended on getting memberships from people door to door. But they were committed to going into neighborhoods where they knew they wouldn't get support and therefore wouldn't get money and wouldn't get much to live on that week, because they felt it was important for people to hear these things, even if they knew they wouldn't get support from particular neighborhoods. So they would knock on door after door after door of people that they knew were making their living off Rocky Flats, which is a plutonium reprocessing plant in the area. And people who are very well off because these they got their livelihood and things like this, or people that just didn't care, and yet they would keep on doing it and live at a very subsistence level because of their commitment to reaching more and more folks about these issues. So I was very impressed by their commitment and their willingness to live on very little money so that they could do this and raise people's awareness.
And I also think that one of the things we have to start doing as Christians is understanding this kind of work as images of Christ in the world. That the only image of Christ available to us is not of someone who has died. I mean, I don't believe that Christ primarily said, I want you to go to church on Sunday and worship me. Christ said, go out there and do this, you know. And so when we see people going out there and doing that, I think we have to value those images of people risking and acting courageously as images of Christ in the world and try and find the same kind of life and meaning in those modern movements as we find in the historical tradition that we're a part of.
It's interesting Elizabeth mentions people knocking on doors because when I first heard the story of Rizpah in the Old Testament, I thought immediately of Jesus' story of the widow at the judge's door who has to return and return and return and knock on the door until finally she gets the attention and the justice that she deserves. But that's a New Testament story, which is also about a sustaining, vigilant persistence. And it's also interesting that these stories are about women. were you going to say something?
No,
what about?
It's true. Yeah, you hit wrong. One of the most phenomenal things that I ever witnessed was Jeannie Yeager when she flew in with Dick Rutan and they had just finished an around the world airplane flight in a very economical, small push-pull experimental aircraft.
Tiny.
And it was phenomenal to see it come in, and it was phenomenal to see the cockpit go out. And she spoke, both Dick and her spoke about their trip, what it was like to live together under those conditions. Mm-hmm. And she kept them going.
What about images or stories of celebration in the midst of struggle? I think that this is one of the issues that particularly white middle-class folks have a lot to learn, and I certainly include myself in that group of folks who have a lot to learn about that. I mean, I find often that it's the people who are in the midst of the most struggle that decide, let's have the biggest party tonight, you know? And there's some need about being that deeply connected to the struggle that calls them to celebrate that deeply, the kind of hope that they're living with at the same time. So I want to, rather than tell more stories or images, invite stories or images you have of celebration in the midst of struggle.
One of the things I was just thinking of before you brought that up, and which mm-hmm. also ties into that, is something that just happened a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if any of you saw it on TV, the Children's Miracle Network telethon, which at first glance, you kind of think, oh no, another organization. You know, out for your money. But I work for Children's Hospital in Seattle, and I know what's behind that, and what all of the money goes for, all the hospitals that are involved in this Children's Network, that money goes strictly for uncompensated care. So that in itself to me is an image of Christ at work. And the celebration part, I guess, comes in the some of the stories they show during the telethon of kids who have been severely ill and who've made it, who've come back, who have gotten on with their lives. And some of the stories, like there was this one boy who had his whole half of his hemisphere of his brain literally blown out, and they had to remove that part of the brain, and the photographs they showed were phenomenal because this guy, the whole side of his head was basically concave at that point. They later then put in an implant, and the kid is celebrating life now. And I don't know, that's a real image that sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Emily?
I think for me, probably the time I was most engaged in the struggle with the community of people was when I worked in public housing projects for 5 years, not that long ago. And the thing that always was wonderful about it was we were working on issues that people had been working on for years. And none of us, I don't think, ever thought we were going to walk into one city council meeting and fix it, or one housing authority meeting. But the fact that I was working with people a lot older than me who knew a lot more than I did, and people who were younger than I was, who had incredible enthusiasm. And, but within that community, there was less cynicism than I've ever experienced anywhere. And speaking of celebration, I just, when you said that, my image was, it seemed like about once a week, we'd all eat together, along with one of our meetings we'll go to on or whatever. And people would bring whatever they had because everyone was living on food stamps, so there was just wild meals. And then somebody'd bring in a boombox, and then all of a sudden there was music, and we would dance, and half the time it would spill out in the yard. And, you know, in the middle of a public housing project where so many people were afraid all of the time to have that kind of celebration and solidarity together, to eat our meals, to dance, to laugh. I mean, it was really wonderful. And I think we all got as much out of that as we got out of anything in terms of keeping the community together and building. And that celebration was always, in fact, I remember at first feeling really awkward there because I wasn't used to that kind of celebrating. And missing it very much now because I don't live anymore in a place where there's that sort of celebration very often. So I think I can relate to that part of the need for celebration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back there.
I'm thinking of how important it is to support groups in need, because it is from those that we who do not need continue to learn, of course. Those of us who do have all that we think we need are too busy in maintenance, no time to celebrate, just holding on to what we've got, and it's really learning from those that we are trying to help or being helped by those people that is the important issue so often, that group, that empathetic group that is really supporting us and giving us the clues to how to celebrate and how to continue. You know, that vigilance that you talk about, we must continue to pray for them so that we can learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
That will turn it out.
I think also that particularly as white middle class folks, we sort of, you know, feel some responsibility for the burdens in the world, and so we feel some responsibility to address those. But I think, and I think that is very appropriate. But I also think that as Christians, we have a responsibility to experience deep joy. That we have a responsibility to be joyful in this world, and if one, you know, negates the other, that's sinful as well. We're called to be joyful human beings, and if we're not able to do that, we need to look at what's in the way. One story that I think of, I worked with the Salvadoran community in Washington, and here I think it's interesting, all our stories of celebration are of third world peoples rather than ourselves, so far anyway. But this woman, who essentially has no money, is undocumented, had a 10-year-old daughter, and she decided that she was going to throw this birthday party for her 10-year-old daughter. And she invited Whit and I to the party. And it was the most amazing party. You know, we had games, we had decorations, we had dancing, we had a full meal with chicken and salad and something else. And then we had a huge pastry shop cake that, you know, I would probably go and think, well, I can't really afford that, so we'll have to get something less, you know. and you know, it was like the elegant kind, you know, with almonds on the side and kiwi fruit on top, you know. And she just had decided that for her daughter, she needed to have this exuberant birthday party. to express her love and as a sign of her joy. And so we went to this party and we had a wonderful time and people accepted us and we danced and all of that. And then a couple weeks later, it was just before Advent last year, I think, we went to the National Cathedral in Washington and they had their Advent celebration. It was all very lovely and everything was in its order. And I was really hungry when I got there and I'm like, well, where's the food, you know? This is a party. This is a multi-million dollar, you know, kind of church structure here. And they're like, well, if you go to the building on the far end of the lawn, there's a little room and there's some cookies in it. You know, I'm like, cookies? And it is just after I'd gone to this party with the Salvadoran woman, and I just thought, you know, out of nothing, this woman created abundance. And, you know, to be a little hard on the National Cathedral, they could have done a lot more in terms of sense of abundance in Advent.
It's really remarkable to me, given the stories that we are surfacing, especially if we claim these as images of God, the kind of theme for this week, the way in which organized churches are continuing to promote this God the Father thing, when all the images we've come up with are the way in which Mother God creates abundance and is vigilant over the over her children. I mean, most of the images we've come up with have been the stern and nurturing teacher, the grieving mother, the outraged mother, the celebrative mother. Now, if these are the life-giving images, maybe it's no wonder the mainline churches are dying. Maybe it's no wonder. I even wonder sometimes, maybe it would be a good thing. Maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing. Then we would, you know, crystallize something that was more life-giving. Well,
that would be another session.
You could shut the tape before that last word.
It is 7:45, and I want to just close with, well, I don't think we've been able to, encapsulate or sort of finish this process by any means. Actually, a section in this book that Juliet showed me just the other evening that I think, as I read it, and I have read this book a number of times but was reacquainted with it as she told me about it, that certainly gives me strength to go on trying. So I want to share that with you as a little offering. And it's in the context of her chapter on gays and lesbians coming out and what kind of witness they can be to the world in that process and to their own humanness. So these are her words. And you whose spirits are sad or unsure, try to remember the very best parts of your life, the loveliest feelings in your body self, occasions of bold delight and quiet confidence, moments of unambivalent commitment and unrestrained joy. Try to remember when you have believed passionately in something or someone, human or divine. Try to imagine that someone now believes in you because she trusts your loveliest feelings, commitments, confidence, joy. She is your friend, whether or not you would have her, for she calls forth the best in you. She comes in the knowledge that together you, she and others embody a moving image of sacred power, a fresh wellspring of relational integrity. She goes with us as we are called forth to go with one another, evoked by historical memory and by voices audible only to ears that can hear the power of God in history. Her name is Love.